Right, hello everyone. Welcome to this fifth and final session of the day. And it's a great pleasure to be able to introduce David Cheetham, who is the head of the School of Philosophy, Religion and Theology. Philosophy, Theology and Religion, no doubt the ordering matters. The University of Birmingham. And also the co-director of the John Hick Centre for Philosophy and Religion at the University of Birmingham. Has worked with John Hick, which qualifies you to talk on any of these religious diversity themes, and has written very, very widely on themes relevant to religious diversity. And today we're going to hear about philosophy of religion and immanence, a new space for multi-faith thinking.
Thank you very much. Well, I mean, normally sometimes when I give papers, I tend to do, I think Ian did a fantastic job of just doing this walking up and down without any script. I've done that before and ended up going off script and then going off somewhere over there. So this time I thought what I would do is I would present a paper to you that I've kind of written up, as it were. And what this paper represents to me is, in a way, several years of really just kind of trying to grasp something that I'm trying to express, gainfully trying to establish some kind of form of ineffability, or talking about the imminent in a way that somehow relates to religion, without using religious terminology. So in my book, Ways of Meeting and the Theology of Religions, that I wrote about 5 years ago, I tried to explore the way in which the arts and these sorts of things of phenomenology may shed an insight on the way that religions might meet, about finding what I thought were alternative profundities, other sorts of things that were going on in the world. And really what I've been searching for since then is a more sort of systematic way of articulating that. And some of the reviewers of that book say, well, why didn't you read phenomenology and all that sort of stuff? And they were, well, I think they were right. And so I've been doing quite as deep as I can study of some of the phenomenologists, people like Jean-Luc Marianne. So I've been dipping in some of the primary literature there. Though I have a fearsome thought that some of you here may, of course, be a deep, knowledgeable people of phenomenology. So I shall run away and take cover after about 40 minutes. Let me give you a story. So, Victoria, she started off with a story about putting shelves in a very categorical way, and I felt very virtuous because I just throw my books onto the shelves. I thought, wow, there we go, I'm a non-Westerner. Sometimes when I have my students, we have an interfaith discussion. Some of you who teach religious studies will know this, is that often in the room you have people, students of very, very deep commitments, Muslims, Christians, Jews, Hindus, Buddhists. And then if in my attempts to therefore create some kind of situation whereby I ask the question, can we pray together or can we do spiritual things together, what would that particularly look like? And I find that many of my students make exceptional claims. They say, well, I can't come along to this. I don't feel comfortable in that particular scenario. So can I be excused? And then one experience I had was I took them, well, instead to the Birmingham Museum. And in the Birmingham Museum, if ever you've been there, you're greeted by a Shiva Nataraja, this huge statue of the Shiva Nataraja. And these same students that had a terrible problem about kind of constructing joint prayers were happy to wander up to this particular object, stare at it for half an hour, let it kind of be absorbed by this particular object. Why? Because they were in a museum and they felt that somehow there was a depth going on to their engagement with these kind of artifacts that they encountered. Or maybe you might transfer that to talking about, say, a beautiful piece of music, the way in which that generates a profundity, maybe a tearful sense of recognition that music can sometimes generate. It can have that kind of effect on you. And what was so interesting is that these students were happy to just dive into that particular kind of profound experience, because they had then identified, maybe in their Western categories, that this was not religious experience. This was something else. This was a profundity, but it wasn't like crossing the Rubicon, whereas they'd be very careful about specifying what scriptures they were happy to read and what they weren't happy to participate in. In this other sort of situation, they felt that this was fine, but it was also deep. And so what's interesting to me is that the province of the philosophy of religion? I once gave that analogy, for example, to in a university in Delhi, and they kind of said, oh, well, it's all part of the same thing. It all leads towards the ocean. It's just one of the several yogas, maybe, that you might practice. So they missed the whole point in my kind of Western way of maybe trying to separate aesthetic experience from religious experience, because I felt that maybe that separation actually was quite helpful in my experience in dealing with some of my students. So how to articulate that? So what I'm talking about today really is the way in which the immanent therefore might function as a space. We've talked about how do we generate categories of thought that might, from which to build maybe a global philosophy of religion. Where are the real life problems possibly? Where do they come from? And how might they be articulated? Do they have a presence about them, those things, that might be even surrogate forms of religious presence? So this is the opening issues. I'm just going to give you an outline. I've got a series of rather random slides, it turns out, that I emailed to Mikkel at 1 o'clock in the morning, because I had to deal with a school matter. So I thought I better give them some slides just to help them through. It turns out these slides actually might end up confusing you more. But here's my opening issues. This is what my focus will be on, what I'm trying to cover. And so I'm going to change these slides as I read through this paper, not because, you know, I'm trying to take a very progressive way, but really just to highlight some of the issues so you remember them maybe as you hear this stuff read out to you. Now, in time honored tradition, of course, I'm going to have a few stabs at John Hick. You can't have a paper on religious beliefs without having a good go at Hick. Not because I'm antagonistic towards it. My own position has moved. I used to be quite vehemently against the pluralistic hypothesis. But now I've come to see it maybe as a much more generous theory, and I should be more generous in my outlook. But I'm not satisfied with the work that it does in terms of how religions might actually interact. I think it's a failure as an overall hypothesis. So in recent work that cites John Hick's use of the transcategorical in the philosophy of religions, Guy Bennett Hunter seeks to rehabilitate the concept of ineffability in philosophy and put it to work. He defines ineffability as that which, in principle, is resistant to conceptual grasp and literal linguistic articulation. He argues that the concept has been neglected in contemporary philosophy and seeks to recommend its usage by both atheists and theists. It is clear that, following the work of David Cooper, he does not think that ineffability is the sole possession of religion. And this is what makes his advocacy of ineffability so interesting, and opens up new possibilities for the future of the philosophy of religion and the scope of its field. Moreover, of particular relevance to my paper, I want to focus my discussion on how ineffability functions in the context of religious pluralism. I will do this by engaging briefly with the work of Jean-Luc Marion at the end and his phenomenological concept of the saturated phenomenon taking place in the immanent. But first I will engage perhaps with a more familiar use of ineffability by John Hick and Perry Schmidt-Leukel, who is, I think if you read his work, he's clearly a disciple of John Hick. So to begin, what is the work then of ineffability? What does it do? The answers that might be offered to this question reflect the classic tension between the idea of ineffability as something beyond comprehension and the possibility of it being spoken about or experienced in some way as a source or ground of meaning. Thus, for some, ineffability can operate only as a formal concept that is experientially beyond reach. For others, it is something that evokes a mysticism that challenges to do philosophy of religion in a new style. I think that's the language of Kevin Shilner. One that is not fixated on rational belief as the sole aspect for consideration, but which reflects critically on the range of cognitive, mystical, experiential, and personal data. Moreover, ineffability is not a concept used only in connection with the divine transcendent object, but certainly for phenomenologists of the second half of the 20th century onwards, might refer to a mysterious sense of depth or excess of meaning that surrounds or underpins life. Although not to be identified with phenomenology as a movement, the philosopher David Cooper seeks to adopt a delicate metaphysical position. By this, he means to water a tightrope that is poised between metaphysics and pure immanence. That is, a sense of beyond the human that is not dependent on identifying it solely with the upper level of a two-levels doctrine of reality. He writes, quote, "Absolutists are right to insist that reality is independent of the human contribution, but wrong to suppose that this reality can be articulated. Humanists, correspondingly, are right to maintain that any discursible world is a human one, but wrong to equate reality with this world." Now, Cooper opens up a perspective where he seeks, without endorsing a transcendent ultimate, to still advance a sense of meaning that is beyond the human. That is, following Heidegger, he maintains that how the world discloses itself to us cannot be our handiwork, and that the sense of unanswerability, or the idea of the measure for human life, owes itself to mystery. Thus, even if Cooper rejects the two-level view of reality, he nonetheless thinks that human life needs ineffability. It needs the presence of what is mysterious. Now, my question is, can religion occupy, or at least accommodate, this delicate position? Or is such a location effectively overruled by the presence of religious metaphysics and subsumed into the transcendent ineffable? If it is possible to admit such a position without contradicting religious faith, then should philosophy of religion identify it as a proper subject matter? And though more of a practical task, could it be generative for a meeting between religions? These are questions that I'll consider towards the end of my paper. But underpinning them is a much broader debate concerning the relationship between analytic and phenomenological traditions in the philosophy of religion. Here, I can only give consideration to this relationship within the remit of my interest in religious pluralism. So, in brief, if the analytic tradition seems to give priority to the challenge that pluralism poses for the objectivity or the epistemology of religious beliefs, the phenomenological tradition concentrates on the givenness or the excess of experiences, including non-religious, that do not appeal to metaphysics. A dialogue between these two approaches to the philosophy of religion may yield new approaches, then, to the question of religious pluralism and the character of a global philosophy of religion, specifically the role played by the ineffable or the transcategorial, and where we locate this in the transcendent or in the immanent. The concept of ineffability, or the inconceivability of the divine, is certainly alive and well in the philosophical discussion about religious pluralism. In fact, for theories of religious pluralism, it is a concept that supplies a vital explanatory component. That is, ineffability provides the transcendent mystery that is deemed necessary to reduce cognitive dissonance generated from conflicting religious truth claims, while simultaneously affirming the basic realism of those religious claims. For example, Perry Schmidt-Leuchel, in a magisterial work that was recently translated from German into English called God Beyond Boundaries, makes the following statement regarding the possibility of a pluralist theology of religions. He says, "The inconceivability of transcendent reality forms the first and fundamental presupposition of a pluralist theology of religions. The critique of a pluralist theology of religions can begin with a refutation of the inconceivability and ineffability of God." So the use or work of ineffability in this way, and Schmidt-Leuchel's acknowledgement that its refutation would serve as a defeater for pluralism, reflects the characterization of a problem that is chiefly about resolving conflicting truth claims about the absolute. However, is there a tension, a paradox even, located in Schmidt-Leuchel's confidence in knowing that divine inconceivability is a linchpin in a theoretical construction situated neatly in the upper story of his two-level account, whilst at the same time asserting its unfathomable nature? Why is the transcategorial so systematically neat in this respect? And Schmidt-Leuchel draws attention to the fact, okay, that ineffability is already part of the common inventory of religions or the traditions of via negativa. Thus, he claims it's entirely consistent with religious accounts. In saying this, chief influence is John Hick. But Hick deploys an intensified mediational epistemology that utilizes Kant's distinction between noumena and phenomena, or rather the distinction between things as they are in themselves and things as they are perceived. Hick borrows this basic idea to suggest the distinction between the literal and the metaphorical status of religious truth claims. According to his hypothesis, which is of course well known, one cannot speak literally of the real en siche. The language used by religions is literal at the phenomenal level of our cultural existence, but is deemed to be only mythologically true of the real en siche. In this way, the real operates as a formal explanatory concept that transcends the concrete, humanly constructed categories of religious experience, which appear to contradict each other. The contradictions only occur on the ground, so to speak, whereas at the noumenal level of the ineffable or transcategorial real, these contradictions do not apply. In short, even though both Schmidt-Leuchten and Hick draw attention to the inconceivability of the divine as the linchpin of their respective pluralist systems, something even further removed from the experiences of the ineffable in different phases being proposed in Hick's model. Thus, Hick is clear that even the profoundest unitive mysticism the mind operates with culturally specific concepts, that which is experienced is accordingly a manifestation of the real rather than the postulated real on siege. That's an important statement, because it's clear that even in the profoundest, so we can't say, Schmidt-Leuchten wants to say, oh, the ineffability that we're postulating is the same ineffability that takes place in all the religions, so what's the problem? All religions think there's an ineffable, so we're just saying the same. But Hick isn't saying the same. What he's saying there is that even in those most profoundest moments, you're not going to access the real, because it's, and he has this way of characterizing it as neither evil nor good, purposive or non-purpose, and so on and so forth. This is an utterly non-obtainable, almost formal postulate without any experiential, you can't obtain the experience of it. So it's beyond the ineffable. George Mavrodi's described it as the super transcendent and said, what a disappointment. So the awkwardness then of this position is that by defending the critically realist nature of profoundly different religious beliefs through his use of the Kantian noumenal phenomenal structure, Hick is forced into making the real so obscure a concept that he's been very famously accused of being a transcendental agnostic. Even a critic is very sympathetic to pluralism as Peter Byrne. It's very interesting that Peter Byrne wrote a book called A Prolegomena to Religious Pluralism. And people think he's a pluralist. He's not. He's just pretending. At the beginning he says, actually, I don't believe in the realism of religious faith at all. But for the sake of my argument, he goes on for 160 pages, he then defends pluralism. But he's actually a non-realist if you read some of the other work that he writes. But even a critic as sympathetic to pluralism as Peter Byrne has recognised that the scepticism, I quote, implied by Hick's distinction between the noumenal and the phenomenal transcendent is severe. So there is, then, the sheer disappointment at the agnosticism about the transcendent. That is, religion may be characterized as a search to get beyond the human and into the ultimate. Religions think that they tell the truth about the way things really are. Although the ineffable is an acknowledged aspect of religious traditions themselves in their discourse about the ultimate, such ineffables do not function absolutely in systems like Hick's. Instead, they are regarded still as phenomenological manifestations, as I've said, of what Mavrodis has called the super-transcendent. In this sense, it is misleading for pluralists to claim that their use of the ineffability is merely continuous with the use that religions make of it. They claim a step further. Here, then, there is a choice that we have to maybe make, maybe we're forced into making a choice, by individual scholars and believers. On the one hand, there is the pluralist's absolute unknowability of the divine. That's the way it works, in order to accommodate seemingly uncontradictory accounts of it. And on the other, there is the possibility, maybe in the end, that a particular revelation might offer a definitive account of the divine, which breaks through the veil to give us knowledge. Or, maybe there's something else. Maybe there is this a reality of the real I wanted to suggest to you right now in the midst, what I would call a transcategorial phenomenon. I have to use, obviously, polysyllabic words to make the concept sound even more impressive. But what I'm really kind of saying is it's the expression of what we might describe as the mystery in the midst, a vividness that's brought out maybe by some of the phenomenological writers that follows the interactions maybe between religions at the level of the immanent, that is generative of the real, as opposed to being something that's imposed in this rather sterilized way as an upper story account of what's going on underneath. How does Hick's treatment of the phenomenological level affect then interactions between religions? Whereas it is offered as an explanatory model, what are the empirical consequences? Even if Hick could maintain that the phenomenal manifestations are real for those experiencing them, thus finding ways to affirm the potency of beliefs, the caveat is surely located in the fact that one can, in principle, move to a different phenomenon, i.e. convert from one religion to another, without changing from the real to something else. Because the noumenal ground is understood to be transcategorial, and moreover our talk of the transcategorial real cannot be understood to enjoy more than a metaphorical status, There is no reason to convert or change faiths other than finding a discourse that suits our personal disposition and development. It seems to have potentially self-defeating consequences, then, for the actual conversation between religions in their phenomena. That is, our concrete beliefs become ultimately inconsequential in such conversations. So what are we talking about? This becomes all the more paradoxical when we realise that one of the motivations for pluralism, besides seeking to formally defend the cognitivity of religious truth claims in light of contradictory plural testimony, is to encourage mutual recognition. In light of the pluralist metaphysical systems in play, this generates the experientially odd consequence that the acknowledgement of the inadequacy of each other's religious beliefs that makes them equally legitimate in each other's eyes. I think at this point, Byrne also worries that pluralism might simply behave as a species of philosophical scepticism about first-order religious claims. If this is the case, we are trained by Higgs' hypothesis to recoil at the possibility that one of us might have more truth about the real than someone else. At least it appears that the terms of reference of such conversations cannot permit outstanding or wholly unique experiences. This is an odd movement of thought, surely, in a philosophy that seeks to engage with a religion, strangely intolerant of its subject matter. As we have said, such a policy of scepticism about each other's claims flows naturally from a tactical epistemological use of ineffability to provide an explanatory structure for the plurality of truth claims. Both Schmidt, Leuchten and Hick are entirely consistent with this when it comes to their comments on the practical tasks of interreligious spirituality. Thus, Schmidt, Leuchten is clear that the purpose of interreligious encounter cannot be to learn more and something new about the divine as it is in itself. Instead, we are likely to learn more and something new about how humans have experienced transcendent reality. Once again, he clearly acknowledges this when he suggests that we will learn less about ultimate reality, but more about faith in its many forms. Likewise, Hick's carefully crafted description of interreligious spirituality as, quote, basically trusting and hopeful and stirred by a sense of joy in celebration of the goodness from the human point of view of the ultimately real, is effectively offered as a tribute to human religiosity than as any insight into the real. Perhaps one important response to these claims of disappointment is to claim that it's unfair, really, to single out Hick and his pluralism for special criticism, because the pluralists can maintain that all traditions have a concept of ineffability present in their thinking and practice. But as I've said, this is beside the point. Whereas first-order religious traditions will often have models of revelation or mystical practices which provide a window into the mystery of the divine, pluralism cannot permit anything like a decisive glimpse into the ultimate to swing things in the direction of any specific account of it. Indeed, we saw earlier that Schmidt-Leuchten claimed the failure of pluralism would be evident if a refutation of the inconceivability of the divine succeeded. So how can the sharing of our experiences or dialogue usefully communicate anything about a reality that is transcategorical without breaking this rule? Such communications are fruitless, and we cannot know if we are growing closer. There is no sense of knowing what convergence between religion might entail. If we compare it to the ultimism proposed by philosophers like Schellenberg, for example, who believe that the proper goal of philosophy, and therefore the true form of religion, according to him, is to pursue the ultimate point, then this might indeed be a shareable goal, but notice that this cannot be a goal within Hick's hypothesis. The real is too distant. There is nothing happening in the phenomenological and in the phenomenal level of Hick's system. There's nothing noumenal. Well, he says the noumenal is present in the phenomenal, but he claims that whatever I do in the phenomenal, I won't know anything more about the real. And maybe this is the essence of what I think is a disappointment about how do you generate the real? How does that have an impingement in a real sense on how religions meet? How can they be generating something on the ground level if it's rendered inadmissible by this kind of policy that says, so it's all part of the noumenal, so it's all happening up here. It's all neither purposes or non-purposes, good or evil. But down here, just stick to where you are. Trust me. I'd like to suggest then that what I'm trying to do is bring that down to this level. Trying to say that, well, Hick is an empiricist. That's to say, he thinks that we get to know more about the truth about religions by looking at the sense data, what's actually happening in the religious experiences themselves. But the one experience he doesn't allow us to have is the experience of pluralism. He doesn't allow us to experience the real, the thing that is actually the conceptual linchpin, the transcategorical. So we need to bring maybe, if we're going to follow Hick's system, maybe we have to generate from an empiricism the real in itself. And maybe that might be more acceptable to religious believers because it's generated out of their own encounters on the ground. How are we doing for time? We're all still awake. Good. So moving towards the second part of my paper. The fundamental problem is that religions are being invited to engage and exchange with each other in their phenomenological manifestations without insight being gained about the upper story. Consequentially, the emergent knowledge is lacking in one important respect. We are not permitted to inhabit the concept of the transcategorial, the pluralist linchpin, in any practical sense, to learn more about the transcendent. Further, even if some kind of convergent spirituality does emerge from the phenomenological engagements, such spiritualities cannot constitute an advance in knowledge about the alleged noumenal real. Although it has formerly belonged comprehension, Hick's transcategorial hardly appears to exceed its well-defined function, i.e. an explanatory device. In this sense, its work is understood. Moreover, this explanatory device, the real, has an organising effect on the phenomena alleged with it. They are organised as soteriocentric, and nothing that is to be counted as genuine religious discourse is allowed to remain outside the structures of that explanation. So as I indicated earlier, is there something counterintuitive about the ineffable being controlled in this way? Or rather, is there a tension located in knowing that divine inconceivability is a linchpin in the theoretical construction, situated neatly in the upper story of this two-level account, whilst at the same time asserting its unfathomable nature? Why is the transcategorical so systemically neat in this respect? So is there another way of considering the transcategorical in the context of religious pluralism, as an experience of excess that emerges in the midst of our interreligious engagements, with its complexity of everyday multiple century cognitive and non-cognitive, natural and human, individual, cultural and social inputs, and even perhaps Cooper's delicate metaphysical position? Put simply, should the work of the pluralist transcategorical be concentrated in its role as an epistemologically pristine noumenal postulate, or instead be something phenomenologically overwhelming, an excess in the midst? The question is how this mystery is generated, how it presents itself to us, how we respond to its presence, and whether we should heed the view that mystery proper only operates at the upper story of the two-level reality noumenal phenomenon. Okay. How much time have we got? There's going to be conversations that has to follow. When does the session end? Okay, so if Hick's Kantian inspired treatment of the phenomenal confines religion into the limits of human construction, the phenomenologist's emphasis on excess may help us develop the notion of a transcategorical phenomenal or mystery in the imminent. Perhaps the most vocal representative in this regard is the French phenomenologist Jean-Luc Marion. And he asked this: can the givenness in presence of each thing be realised without any condition or restriction? For him, if phenomenology is concerned with reduction, in the Husserlian tradition, back to the things themselves, then surely this phenomenological reduction, having embarked on a reductive path, needs to go the whole way. So Marion's radical conclusion is that the sheer givenness of phenomena means freeing it from the limits of every authority, including those of intuition. So for our purposes, we began this paper by asking about the work of ineffability in the context of religious pluralism. If we hoped this to do some work, not just as a philosophical noumenal device, then it seems that the work of the phenomenologist has something to contribute. This is not to propose that the theoretical conditions of truth should be brushed aside, but that the phenomenological description of the givenness of experience, especially the excess of what is given, may suggest a more authentic starting point for religious believers when it comes to the recognition of what John Caputo describes as things that are not under our control. It is authentic just because the experiences of interreligious meeting or spirituality do not always arise out of deliberate positioning, either intellectual or experiential, but, as some people have said today, from embedded contexts, moments, and happenings that occur. Such recognition is, I would submit, descriptive of a genuine experience of religious pluralism rather than the philosophical idol of Hicks' pluralistic hypothesis. For phenomenologists, I did choose that word, of course, I have to say it again. For phenomenologists like Jean-Luc Mariam, the excess of intuition we experience at looking at the spectacular landscape painting, or the dazzling apprehensions of the face of the one we love, or the yet deeper intimation of a divinely benevolent invisible gaze, are all saturated phenomena that build towards a realization that effectively comes down to thinking about that about which none greater can be conceived. Which means thinking that kind of Anselmian idea is the final possibility, says Mariam, of phenomenology. And the dynamic that is suggested here is intriguing. Mariam appears to be proposing that the experience of saturated phenomena is something that makes one receptive to that which exceeds all. Anselm's that which none greater can be conceived. Put another way, the formal category of Hicks' transcategorial is turned into a living phenomenological possibility. To understand this further, we need to take just a quick closer look at Jean-Luc Mariam and his context of saturated phenomena. And I'm just going to give something on this because I'm aware of time passing, so I'm going to try to... I don't need to change the sign. So if Hicks borrows Kant's noumenal phenomenal distinction to construct his pluralistic hypothesis, with its division between the real as it is and the real as it is experienced, Mariam finds in Kant a warrant for his influential notion of saturated phenomena. The experience of being bedazzled, the experience of givenness and excess. For Mariam, we are the given to, and the given to is overwhelmed, saturated by the object. To be clear, this is not true of all cases. Mariam thinks that there are degrees of phenomenality, ranging from poor or common phenomena, such as logic and mathematics, which do not need much more than a concept alone, as he says, to show themselves, to saturated phenomena, such as revelatory experiences, where, he says, intuition surpasses intention. In this sense, Mariam's construction is different, if you notice, from Hicks' account of things known according to the mode of the knower, which would seem to bestow a great deal of legislative power onto the perceptual structure of our human psychology and consciousness. And Mariam is resistant to this idea, so there's a very important quote here, he says, where he tries to break out of Kant's kind of new distinctions. Givenness precedes intuition, he writes, and abolishes its Kantian limits, because the fact of being given to consciousness in whatever manner testifies to the right of phenomena to be received as such, that is to say, they give themselves as they give themselves. To return to the things themselves amounts to recognizing phenomena as themselves without submitting them to the, here we go, the sufficient condition of an anterior authority, and he says this, such as the thing in itself, cause or principle. And Mariam finds the origin of his doctrine of saturated phenomena in Kant's critique of aesthetic ideas. He notes that in the case of the Kantian view, it is not the intuition, but the concept which is lacking. Kant says that by an aesthetic idea, I mean that representation of the imagination which evokes much thought, yet without the possibility of any definite thought whatever, i.e. concept, being adequate to it, and which language consequently can never quite fully capture or render completely intelligible. And Mariam seizes upon Kant's comment, evokes much thought, and is also drawn to a further statement by Kant in which he argues that the aesthetic idea may be called an inexponable representation of the imagination. I think inexponable means it can't be reduced. And Mariam translates inexponable as inexposable and suggests that herein is located the notion of excess. And he says this, one can understand this in the following way, because it gives much, the aesthetic idea gives more than any concept can expose. To expose here amounts to arranging the intuitive given according to rules. So, let me try and move to a more of a conclusion, even though I have about 7 pages left, but I'm not going to torture you, don't worry. So returning to issues of religious pluralism and ineffability, may we describe it as something that evokes much thought? an experience that seems to overflow marked out territories. And one such marked out territory would be the question of the underlying exclusivist, inclusivist, pluralist operative in the philosophy of religion's position. But this is precisely the sort of designation that appears inadmissible because the experience, taken by itself, gives more than can be described. Thus, rather than pluralistic spirituality being articulated as a form of deliberate positioning or programmatic dialogue set within a soteriological framework, can it be something that arises out of an event or a happening, a matter less focused on the conceptual hygiene of the real, and more on some experience of excess, or what might be called the transcategorical phenomenal, a ground-up concept set within the context of Marin's work on saturated phenomena? It takes on a significance, particularly with one aspect of saturated phenomena analysed by Marin, the event. I think I've got a quote about the event, at least I hope I have. No, I haven't. Okay. Let me read you this about the event. So Marin says, what is an event? If you were to describe an event, how would you describe it? Would you better capture the whole event? And he says this: the event does not result from production, which would deliver it as a product, decided and foreseen, foreseeable according to its causes and as a consequence reproducible following the repetition of such causes. To the contrary, in happening, it attests to an unforeseeable origin, rising up from causes unknown, even absent, at least non-assignable, that one would no longer be able to reproduce it. So really what he describes the event as being is something that saturates the category of quantity. What is the Battle of Waterloo? Do you know what the Battle of Waterloo is? There are so many ways in which the Battle of Waterloo has its origins and beginnings and starting points. It just has an excess of different original points. And so Marin says that nobody ever saw the Battle of Waterloo. It just was an event that took place, an excess. And I suppose what my question is, therefore, is that does this surplus or excess of an event aptly describe the event of an interfaith meeting? The event of actually meeting another? And how generative is it, therefore, to describe the meeting of religions in this particular sort of way as an event that is somehow saturated with meaning and has different kind of starting points according to the players that are in this particular event? It's not all subsumed within, yes, that's all part of the real, either evil or good or purpose or not. It's actually something that's generated from the event or the moment of meeting. So looking back to Hick, viewed in relation to the pluralist theology of religions, such saturated interreligious events may be seen sub specie eternitatis, or rather they may take on significance only because they are deemed to illustrate a deeper pluralist or universal reality to which they bear witness. However, our consideration of the phenomenological view suggests that if taken as they appear in themselves, such events may enjoy greater liberty. That is, phenomenology goes beyond metaphysics insofar as it gives up the transcendental project in order to allow the development of a finely radical empiricism. Or further, the phenomenologist wishes to return ownership of the apparent to what appears and phenomenality to the phenomenon. I'm going to end it there.